Welcome to the C-Suite, a program designed for executives and those working with those at the C-level, and a service of Safe America Foundation and its CEO network. Now, here's your C-Suite host, Len Pagano.
Well, hello, and it's good to have you here with us in the C-Suite. I'm Len Pagano, president of the Safe America Foundation, and we're glad to be here with our friends at Business Radio X. Ryan's doing a great job here at the board, and we're glad to have the owners of the station here with us. But I'm here to talk today to a new friend who's just a delightful woman, and you talk about somebody who is impressive. Kim Ryan is impressive on several levels. She's an executive who is running the Wellstar Atlanta Medical Center. She has a wonderful history, and we're going to get to hear some of the stories behind her career in medicine this afternoon. And so I'll start off with saying welcome, Kim.
Thank you, Len. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, it's great to have a chance to chat with you and share something of your story and what you care about as an executive. Just as a kind of a simple starting point, tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, I started in nursing as a new graduate. I was in a hospital's ICU in Chicago and learned to love it. And then went back to where I came from, which is Rochester, New York, and went to grad school and worked my way through grad school and got into level one trauma center emergency room. And that is certainly my passion.
How did you make the transition from nursing into medical management, healthcare management?
I was a clinical nurse specialist, which is a nurse that works in a hospital with a master's, and you do nursing research and education and clinical. There was an opening for an administrator of a children's hospital where I was working at the Medical Center of Central Georgia in Macon. I had never thought about administration before, but I talked to the woman that was leaving that position and thought, this might be an incredible experience. So took that position and spent 6 years as the administrator of the children's hospital, and really began to understand that there needed to be a clinical voice at the strategic table. That really was the defining moment for me that led me to chief nurse and chief operating officer and CEO.
So you went from Macon to New Orleans.
I did.
And what was that all about? What was going on there?
In New Orleans, they needed an administrator for their children's hospital. And it was a tertiary and quaternary care facility. And what that means is that they took care of the sickest of the sick. They had a lot of transplant programs, heart transplant, abdominal transplant, bone marrow transplant, congenital heart surgery, resculpting a neonate's heart. So that was a step up in my career there. And I spent 10 years at Tulane in New Orleans and just loved the city and loved the Academic Medical Center and spent a lot of good time there.
Well, everybody thinks of New Orleans as a great city. I'm sure that was a lot of fun just, you know, culinary-wise, but you are also getting a lot of experience, and you also went through Katrina. Tell us what that was like.
So I was had the life-altering positive experience to be the incident commander at Tulane during Katrina. We had spent 7 years prior to Katrina practicing, because every year that I was there, we opened the command center at least once and found things that we did well and also things that we wanted to improve, which really helped us during Katrina in August 29th of 2005, because we had perfected the processes. And it was an incredible journey that we took for a week there and got all our patients safely evacuated off the roof and to another hospital and had a phenomenal team.
It must have been, you know, I mean, everyone who I've ever met who's been in New Orleans and was there for Katrina, it was a life-altering experience. So what was that like for you?
I had 2,605 employees. And 80% of them lost everything. Mm-hmm. But yet they were there with me, working together with one vision and one mission, and that was to provide exemplary care to our patients. And we lost power within 5 or 10 minutes of the storm making landfall, so we weren't focused on what the rest of the country was seeing on the on the TV and the radio. We were focused on caring for our patients. And you know, there were two decisions that were made by our staff that allowed us to not lose any patients. And to lead that effort was just incredible.
Hmm. Well, so many people that I've talked to, you know, and again, as you know, Safe America has been involved in preparedness since 2009, a few years after Katrina. I'm sorry, actually, it was earlier than that, but this particular program, which we have today called Be Safe America, was started in 2009. And all of the things that happened both from 9/11 and Katrina contributed to our perspective. And, you know, one of the things that I felt as an American after 9/11 and Katrina was that the average person really doesn't know what to do in an emergency. And for the most part, we all think we watch too many Westerns. We expect the sheriff and the posse, you know, somebody's going to come rescue us. And obviously that didn't happen. And watching the videos at the time, the live broadcast from New Orleans, and I remember, I think that was when Anderson Cooper really became famous. It was shocking to see all of the things that fell apart in the culture, in the community, and knowing that there were a lot of good people there like yourself. You know, it reminded me that even with a good leadership, you still have to have the average person be able to handle things for maybe 3, 4, 5 days, whatever. And so one of our phrases that we developed that hopefully we can work on together was a phrase that I kind of penned, which was, you have to be your own first responder.
That's exactly right.
And so as you saw that firsthand, I'm sure you saw examples of that. We at Safe America have been trying through this program, Be Safe America, to every year have in the fall sort of a season of drills and to get people to do some sort of drill. One of the things that we have focused on that's fairly simplistic is a texting drill. And we came up with the term text first, talk second, because in an emergency, oftentimes, you know, you weren't able to get through with a voice line or a cell phone call. And I remember we did some research with the University of Missouri. This is how some of this developed. As a former journalist, I was doing work with Dr. Rob Duncan at the University of Missouri. He was vice chancellor for research. And I said, you know, can you kind of equate how much space it takes for an average phone call on a cell phone versus if people were going to use text messages? And he came back and found that it was the equivalent of about 60,000 text messages could get through in 1 hour versus one cell phone digital call.
Wow.
So, you know, we said you have a 60,000 to one advantage if you're trying to text, knowing that even if it doesn't go through immediately, it'll probably stay in the queue. Whereas if you get a cell line that doesn't connect, it doesn't stay in the queue. So we've worked with FEMA and a number of companies, and this all started back in 2009. And I think about Katrina because a lot of people at the time told us how they learned how to text through that event. And so since then, we've used Katrina kind of as a role model. And of course, you were on the ground doing important work, saving lives. So hopefully, as a new Safe America board member, we can utilize your leadership and skills to help get that message further out there. And to transition back to a question, if I said to you, what do you think we need as a country here to help make the average person more engaged or ready for an emergency?
You know, I think what you said about drilling is so important. And even those 7 years before Katrina hit New Orleans, yes, we drilled. We drilled with the city. We drilled with the other hospitals close by us. But we failed because what we were drilling each and every one of those years before was a single disaster. Mm-hmm. And that it was a hurricane because we knew we were vulnerable. We knew New Orleans was below sea level. We never thought to drill about multiple disasters at one time. And what Katrina gave us was the hurricane, the winds, the storm surge, then the flooding, and then civil unrest. And that brought a lot of the city to their knees. Mm-hmm. And we did well during it. I have a very amusing story I want to tell with respect to texting, though, because I was not a texter prior to that. And we were in the command center, and within 10 minutes or so, we lost emergency generator. We went on emergency generator power. Our landlines didn't work. Our mobile phones didn't work. We had satellite phones. Unfortunately, there was a solar flare at the same time Katrina hit. So the satellite phones didn't work. And we had six communication sessions a day, one in the morning and one in the evening with our physician leaders and then our administrators and then patients' families. And so I was totally transparent with what was going on. And so it was the patient family communication session right after we had lost all of the ways we knew to communicate. And the father of one of our pediatric ICU patients came up to me after and said, you know, what about texting? And I said, you know, I don't think anyone in the command center knows how to text. And he said, well, my son, it can go in the wheelchair to the command center, and he taught us how to text. And that's what we used pretty extensively there forward.
What a great story.
Yeah, we can learn from our young ones.
That's wonderful. And we're going to share that story. And I think this is great. Wonderful you're sharing that today.
Thank you.
You know, in terms of as you now look at what you're doing here in Atlanta, what's your goal as running Atlanta Medical Center?
It's the same goal that WellStar has, the vision that WellStar has, and that's to provide world-class healthcare. We have a phenomenal opportunity to be part of one of the greatest healthcare companies that I've worked for. And we have an opportunity to impact so many people's lives positively. And so that is what I look forward to every day when I get up.
Well, having worked with WellStar in the past, as you've already given them a wonderful, you know, kind of accolade, I will say, I agreeing with you, ditto that. WellStar is a wonderful, wonderful health system. And my wife and I live in, as you know, Marietta in Cobb County, and we've had many occasions to use WellStar and Kennestone Hospital in our family, and I think they've always been wonderful. And I think that that's wonderful that Atlanta Medical Center now is part of that system. And as you look at the population you are dealing with, I guess you have probably one of the more challenging populations, the demographics of Atlanta. I guess you really have a mix, don't you?
We do. We have very affluent individuals, citizens, and then we have citizens that really need access to care. They don't have transportation. They don't have a physician. And they utilize our services to provide some pretty dramatic health care.
Well, and one of the populations that, thanks to you, we're working with there are veterans.
Absolutely.
And just to acknowledge the kindness that you and WellStar has had to help Safe America, we have a veteran center that some of our listeners may not be familiar with called Homefront. And the whole goal of a Homefront center was to deal with those veterans facing issues transitioning from the military to civilian life. And we have seen, as you've heard already, a number of cases and a number of individuals briefing them on what services are available and trying to kind of aggregate together the very, very many different groups that are out there, veteran service organizations or average other organizations. And I think one of the challenges to me is that there are so many voices, you know, that there's a sense of some veterans have said to us, we just don't know where to turn for help. And certainly the VA has had many issues that they're still having to deal with. So we're trying to fill the gap. And I think together, you know, one of the things we're hoping is this can even mushroom for the benefit of WellStar, that we can refer people to WellStar and do some good together that hasn't been done yet.
I'm real excited to work with you on that. You know, I'm the daughter of a veteran. My dad, I moved here from Northern Virginia. He's in his mid-80s, and he has some healthcare needs. And I'm pretty savvy negotiating around healthcare, but I'll tell you, it took me many, many months to get him the care that he needed through the VA. And it's just because it's a different, complex system, different than the healthcare systems I'm used to. So I look forward to working with you to make a difference in people's lives that have served us so bravely.
And to that end, you know, as we go forward, if there's some ideas that you have, you know, I think that one of the things I've been tickled about are the very many groups that are not directly involved with veterans, but who volunteered, you know, working with companies, whether it's UPS, Norfolk Southern, Cox, WSB-TV, which is, as you know, been a very big proponent of our programming. And through our Safe Communities Task Force, we have reached out and will continue to try to grow the coalition. And And I think one other population that I've been lately been studying that's one that hasn't really gotten engaged too much yet are the pre-millennials, the people we call the selfie generation, the self generation. And I was in Washington meeting with a young woman who just graduated from Marymount College or University, and she was in 2002 our safest kid in America. Now imagine this young girl who, after 9/11, had an uncle who was in the military, and she drew a picture and told the story of how she felt safer thanks to the military. And we thought it really captured at the time the importance of the military and safety. You know, the communities are safer because of military involvement. And it's ironic now, here it is 14 years later, she's graduated from college, and we were visiting, and I said to her, what can we do to help this generation get engaged? And I was interested to find one of the populations that they care about are veterans, which I was sort of surprised that they had that much of a affinity. But then again, thinking about this young girl who's now 21, her family has a lot of members that are military. So I guess that would make sense. But I think, you know, to see the young generation, how can we engage them and how we can teach them to give back? I know there are a lot of groups, civic clubs, that worry about, can they get people to join Rotary or Civitan or, you know, Kiwanis. And so I think one of the challenges that Safe America is hoping to work with, you know, you and Wellstar and all of our members would be on how do we engage that generation? And I'm just to pose this question, how do you think we can engage those under 21? Do you think there's any special way we need to address their interest to get them committed?
You know, I think a lot of it is listening to them, listening to what's important to them. They have incredible perspective that we didn't have and we don't have. Their use of technology and their perspective on the world and work-life balance. And they are a caring generation. You've just got to tap into what they're passionate about.
That's a good point. And I guess social media is such an important tool for them. Their major means of communicating that you're right. If I were to ask you, as you think about where we are today as a culture and what can healthcare do to help change society, what are thoughts in your mind? Are there some things that you are wanting to tackle that we can work on together, or things that are being addressed beneath the surface that maybe the public doesn't recognize?
Medicine and healthcare is changing at such a rapid pace that it's an incredible opportunity for all of us, but I feel privileged to be where I am to help in some small way change the culture, change how we feel about and how healthcare is delivered. You know, that same generation we were just talking about, they don't want to wait 2 weeks to get in to see a doctor. And so what are we seeing? We're seeing Skyping going on between someone that has a cough and a provider. You know, for a small amount of money, you have your 15 minutes and they can diagnose your, you know, tonsillitis or strep throat or, you know, pneumonia and get you the prescriptions that you need called into the pharmacy. So part of it is, you know, what we valued when I was entering nursing is different, and we've got to be able to change with time. And then for the less fortunate, we've got to find ways to prevent disease and to get them access to health care, not illness care, health care, where they live. I know some of the demonstration projects that I've been involved in is working with the ambulance companies, EMS, and we know where the patients are that come frequently to hospitals. And that's normally because they've run out of medications, they don't have the money to go to their primary care provider. And some of the good work that's going on now is identifying those frequent utilizers and before they call 911 or as they are calling 911, triage the 911 calls that don't seem to be emergent and send the team to them. So I think we've got to be nimble and we've got to think out of the box.
Mm. Well, and I guess one of the challenges is even though, you know, medicine has a and necessity, I guess with the economics changing and the government's subsidies in certain ways, right, and Medicare, Medicaid changing, it's always a challenge, isn't it, to go from one year financial year to the next and still either make money, break even, whatever. And that must be, is that part of it, would you say, the major challenge you face as a health administrator? Or is it beyond that?
You know, it is certainly part of that. One plan year to the next, your deductibles change, your insurance carrier changes. We have very high deductible plans right now. High deductible plans, while you get coverage, the first $5,000 to $10,000 is out of your pocket. And so we see some of the same issues that we had before. The less fortunate can't afford it. And so they delay until they get sicker and sicker and sicker. And then they come in through the emergency department and, you know, it could be catastrophic care that we're dealing with at that point.
Well, you know, I guess the thing that strikes me is as we go through this presidential election year, there's so much rhetoric. And when you get away from that and get down to what's going to happen, whoever is elected, I guess the reality is there are going to continue to be significant changes over the next 2 to 5 years, aren't there?
Yeah. I mean, change is already happening, and it's going to continue. And it's going to be exciting to see where we get to, because it's going to be a lot different than where we are now.
You're hoping it's going to be better or believe it will be?
Both.
Good. Well, we'll pray that it is better because I know that there's so many people still aren't covered. I guess there's that sense of even Obamacare with all of its rhetoric hasn't solved that problem.
And we haven't found out how to deliver wellness care. We are one of the best nations, if not the best nations, in illness care. You know, if someone is having a heart attack, we've got it down. We know exactly what needs to be done in what order, and we can have really good outcomes. We don't do very well preventing heart attacks. We know what we have to do as a society. We know how we have to eat. Mm-hmm. We know we need to exercise. We know we need to manage our blood pressure, but we don't. And that's, I believe, the major focus we need to work on. Dealing with the obesity epidemic, I'm one that used to exercise a lot, and now I get up at 4:30 and get to work and come home at 8:30. Exercise has gone by the wayside, and that's not the way it should be. So
I'm in the same boat with you, unfortunately. And I think what you're saying reminds me of a very personal issue as the president of Safe America that I've been facing for 22 years. And that is, how do you popularize something that isn't just instinctively popular? I mean, you talk about wellness and all of the things that go with that, including not only exercise, but nutrition and i.e. not eating the junk food that's so commonplace. It's one of those things where, you know, as a communicator, I've always found it interesting how you can see some topics that are easy to popularize, but some of these just aren't, you know. And again, if you look at the average commercial message, which is preaching to continue to eat junk food or fast food, which often isn't very nutritional, and then the lack of, even if there's no messaging out there, on exercise, really. I think most people understand that's important, but to make that commitment, as you're saying, is really hard when people are working 12 to 18, 14 hours a day. And to the degree that, you know, I don't think you want to get up at 3:30 to start exercising or start it at 8:30 at night. So how do you fit that into your day schedule? You know, and that's, I guess, part of the challenge is changing culture.
That's right. And, you know, I was in Gwinnett County when I first came back to Atlanta about 7 years ago. I think it's all about partnerships. And so one of the first things that I did at that healthcare facility was to partner with Gwinnett Parks and Recreation. We put together what was called Walk the Talk. And it was meeting at one of the parks and advertising and having me or a physician with a mic. And while we were walking the park, we were teaching healthy behaviors. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's good. But can we, who are workers, interrupt our busy day to do that. So I think it's incumbent on our facilities that we're working at to have time carved out and walking groups or, you know, yoga after work or whatever it is, and have healthy foods in our cafeterias where we work, and teach our employees what are healthy alternatives.
Agreeing with you, one of the other things that came up in my mind as we were teaching driving skills to young people, teen drivers, through our driving school, and when cell phones and texting messaging got to be a big issue, a problem, one of the things that I started to think about, and we frankly haven't introduced this yet, but it's staying in my mind that we should, and that is, as we go through teaching a 36-hour driving course, that we need to have almost like an AA meeting for young people that are used to texting when they're driving, and say, you know, let's talk it through. And is it really that important that you need to be texting while you're driving? And part of the challenge, I think, in all of these areas is that we have to find ways to have people communicate to each other and make kind of a commitment. It's like the buddy system, that not only will I not text, or I will exercise, or I won't eat McDonald's every day, you know, double cheeseburger for lunch, that, you know, we make that commitment beyond ourselves, because as long as we keep it within our own mind, it's always easy to excuse yourself because you don't have to answer really to yourself, or at least it's easier to forgive yourself. And I think that's where I think AA and those various programs that have built a kind of a tradition of people communicating and sharing the weaknesses we have. And as a culture, again, I think that you're hitting some points that affect healthcare. You know, as you say, illness is one thing, but health maintenance and how do you keep yourself healthy? Back to, I guess, your leadership. I think what's wonderful in hearing your approach, Kim, is all of these things that you are trying to do through Atlanta Medical Center and WellStar, and really trying to make a difference. And if you were going to say, what's the legacy? You're still a young woman, but if you look out a few decades, what do you hope will be your legacy?
I want to make sure at the end of my career and at the end of my life, I can say that I've bettered the health of the communities that I've lived in. And that's what does it for me. And that's partnering with Safe America, partnering with the communities that we serve to make sure the focus is on health, really getting out there and finding out the needs of the community that we serve. I believe that hospitals exist for one reason, and that's to improve the health of the community and to find out you've got to be in the community. You gotta be among the citizens to determine what needs they have. And then you need to meet those needs.
If it's helpful, we certainly love to use a Safe Communities meeting as a forum for you and have you be the moderator, take the stage, if you will, and see what we can do to bring the community together too.
Absolutely.
One thing, I was just writing a note to myself. You talk about legacy, and I have to say safety is a hard area to kind of describe to people, much less say, here's what I'm trying to accomplish. Because as long as you don't have a car crash, you know, if you really did benefit from safety education, it's really invisible. But one of the things, Dr. Rick Martinez, who I knew years ago when he was heading up the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, that's a Rick had some great ways of translating safety for people. And from an economic point of view, he would say, you know, how long a person stays in healthcare after a car crash can be very expensive, far more expensive than a funeral. So he would always try to point out, look at the difference economically that it costs to have somebody who's a paraplegic be cared for 20 or 30 years. To take it from a more positive point of view, his was kind of the negative downside of the cost of non-safety. I looked at the positive aspect of what if we are able to extend life, and averaging that if a person were to live an extra 10 years and average 10 good deeds a day, that would mean that they would have accomplished 36,350 or something equivalent to that, good deeds, actively helping people, doing things, you know. And again, using quantifying it to 36,000 good deeds, I hope we can have the average person live to do that many more good things. And again, it's one of those things that I share this as a new friend. Hopefully we can do that together.
Yeah, what a great way to think about it. You know, paying it forward.
That's it. That's really it. And we have a board member you haven't met yet who'll be able to share how he does that through something, a concept called net weaving. Bob Littell has been a wonderful new board member. And as he has described it to me, it's doing very much that. So we have, I think we're closing in on the last few minutes here. And as we kind of bring it to a close, I would ask you maybe, again, a question or two as a, this one, I would just say as a female executive. You know, this is the our program called C-Suite, and we're trying to engage senior executives, C-Suite executives. How do you see yourself as a role model for other women? I'm sure you do. How does that impact you?
One thing that I love to do is mentor. I was mentored as a young adult. It's a way to give back. And there's a lot of opportunities where I work for nurses, for respiratory therapists, for housekeepers that want to make a difference. And I embrace them and give all the time that I can to them in their growth because they're our future. What a wonderful thing that they want to learn. I've learned some good lessons along my phenomenal career that I am happy to share.
Well, listen, hearing that, I would love for us to find and use Safe America as a platform for that.
Absolutely.
You know, I think our program here today, if we can share this with young women that are either in healthcare or other fields, I think this you're a wonderful example of a fine executive.
Thank you so much.
Well, Kim Ryan, thank you for being our guest on this inaugural program, and we look forward to working together at Safe America. And for all of you listening in, thanks for listening to the C-Suite. Have a good rest of the day.
Join us each Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern for the C-Suite, a co-production of Business Radio X and the Safe America Foundation. To learn more about leadership services for the C-Suite and membership, visit safeamerica.org. Or call the Safe America Foundation at 770-973-SAFE. Thanks for joining us. And remember, at Safe America, anyone can be a CEO or Community Engagement Officer.